got this title, How We Benefit from the Sangha and How the Sangha Benefits from Us. So in a way, like I say, it's just kind of pulling out the... in a way, it's making explicit the purpose of running these sorts of evenings. So Sangha is a, of course, like most of you are familiar with that term, but just to kind of make it so we all know what we're talking about. Sangha is one of the three jewels of Buddhism, and it's a very rich and full word. It means a variety of different things. Sangha means, it literally translates spiritual community. That word can be used to kind of describe enlightened beings. Yeah, so the community of enlightened beings. There's these pictures around this room. All of these figures, they're the enlightened Sangha. Then, stepping down a step or two, this kind of us lot. Yeah, the Sangha. The Sangha is human beings having a go. Yeah, and there you've got kind of like, you have sort of like all different sizes of Sanghas. You've got like the Birmingham Buddhist Centre Sangha. You've got the Sangha of the kind of like the people who you kind of know at the Buddhist Centre, who you're pleased to see and you say hello to when you show up. You've got the Sangha of, you've got the Triratna Buddhist community as a wider Sangha. Obviously, you've got the Triratna Buddhist Order as a Sangha, which is for like at the heart of the wider Triratna Buddhist community. Then you've got all the people who've even vaguely identify as being Buddhists. That's a Sangha. And all the other Sanghas as well, like the NKT, the Sogyo Gakkai, the Theravadins, blah, blah, blah. But then you've got another kind of, and Sangha's also got another meaning, which in a way people are less familiar with, but it's actually the most important. And that is Sangha as, that is Sangha as possibility. Yeah, Sangha, the kind of the ideal of Sangha, the principle of Sangha is, what is it like when human beings communicate with each other when they're not solely preoccupied with their own wants and desires? Yeah, a Sangha predicated on people being free to a substantial degree from self-orientation. What's the energy like of those interactions? What's the, you know, like when we were doing that thing at the start, I was saying like, it's like one of the defining features of an enlightened being is that they're open. Yeah, they're open. They substantially reduced the levels of delusion, hatred, and greed that they experience. So they're just really open to life. Yeah, that openness creates a lot of energy. So what happens when you have a lot of those, or even a few of those people interacting with each other? Yeah, that, and you know, like it's this, you know, like this kind of like energy bouncing back and forth off of each other, and more energy being created. You could say that's the most important. That ideal, that possibility of human beings relating to each other in that way, that's what Sangha really is. That's what the archetypal Sangha represent, and that's what we, to some extent, are trying to manifest. So yes, so how we benefit from the Sangha and how the Sangha benefits from us. So Triratna, as you probably realise, places a substantial emphasis on Sangha, much more so than other Buddhist traditions. So we've got a particular take on why that's important. So yeah, just to say that. And in a way we do that, well, we'll come back to why we do that. So I'm just going to tell you a couple of short stories from the Pali Canon, stories from the Buddha's life, which illustrate these two principles, how we benefit from the Sangha and how the Sangha benefits from us. For those of you who aren't used to me, I cut corners in telling stories. I substantially rephrase things, so this isn't going to be a completely kind of traditional rendition of these stories, so I apologise for that, if you find things like that a bit strange. So the first story is the story of Magia. Magia's a young monk, he's kind of wandering around, he's hanging out with the Buddha, he's the Buddha's attendant. And Magia wants to go off and meditate. He wants to grow and make spiritual progress. And he goes to the Buddha and says, Buddha, I want to go and meditate. And the Buddha says, stay here, hang out with me for a while. And Magia's like, no, you've done it all. I want to go and meditate so I can do it all too. The Buddha says, no, stay here. They have this little back and forth. And then Magia keeps on saying, look, you've done it all. Let me go off and do it all. And in the end of the day, the Buddha traditionally, if you ask the Buddha for something three times, he'll do it, even if he knows it's a bad idea. He's like, well, if you really want it, then what's the point in arguing? So he says, okay, how can I stop you when you talk of meditation and striving? Go off and meditate on your own. McGeer goes off, meditates on his own, gets in a pickle, just gets lost in greed, predominantly hatred and delusion. And he comes back to Buddha with his tail between his legs saying, I wanted to meditate and kind of grow and develop and it hasn't worked, why not? And the Buddha, kind of quite sort of, reasonably bluntly, but presumably also with some kindness, just kind of talks to McGeer. And the phrase he uses, he says, when the heart's release is immature, when the heart's release is immature. So that's quite an interesting phrase, isn't it? When the heart's release is immature. Obviously, different metaphors in the Buddhist tradition appeal to different people. For something for me, like this image of release, I was like, I really respond to that. So yes, when the heart's release is immature, these things will help. And the first thing he talks about is a technical word. He talks about kalyana mitrata. Kalyana mitrata is friendship connection with what is good, what is spiritual. So really that's kind of like, that's what we're doing, that's what this Buddhist centre is about, that's what true Ratna is about, that's what Sangha is about. It's about connecting with other people in a beneficial, growth-inducing way. And the Buddha goes on to kind of like list out a whole image of the Buddhist path, saying, if you do this, that and the other, then your heart will mature, you will find release. But he comes back to the importance of kalyana mitrata. That's the first thing, that's the first factor. And you could say, so what is that? What is kalyana mitrata? This is where I'm going to go slightly off piece, but I'm making a point. Or you could say, well, what is it? How does that help us? And you could say that you get three different things. First of all, you just get kind of like you get teaching. It's like, like all of you at some point came to a Buddhist center and somebody said, sit down, shut your eyes, and breathe in, breathe out, count one. Yeah. So just like direct in information impartment. Yeah. So that's teaching, and that's part of kalyana mitrata, kind of communicating the Dharma. Then the second bit, you could say, is kind of encouragement and exemplification. And again, this is part of relationship. So probably, again, for most of us, some man or some woman said, close your eyes, count to one, count to ten slowly. And you liked it and you came back. Probably for most of you, there was something about the person that you were interested in. So it wasn't just sort of information communication. You could have, like some computer could have told you to do that, but there was something about the individual that you responded to. So you could say that's, exemplification. Which is an aspect of communication. You can only exemplify when you're in communication with people. Communication doesn't necessarily mean words. It can be very, very short. One of my teachers, Subhuti, talks about his first encounter with Sangharachita. And it was a non-verbal encounter. They lived in the same area of London. It was just before Subhuti. He'd never even heard of meditation. He was just walking down the road one day, going up the park to get stoned. And he saw this guy walking the other way. And Sangharachita looked weird in those days. He was wearing robes with a big cloak and a staff, he looked like Gandalf. And Subhuti was like, who wasn't called Subhuti, he was like, there's someone, he didn't know what to make of it, but it was like, and it wasn't just the guy looked weird, he was like, he had a presence, which he found attractive, kind of touching, striking. And then finally, there's sort of like, kalyana mitrata as relationship, as connection, as friendship even. Becoming involved with each other. Again, remember earlier I was talking about this idea of openness. So the Buddhist tradition, one conception of enlightenment is openness. And, Sangharachita is really, really clear. Like, we talk about all of this, like, realizing non-self, kind of like, realizing wisdom, seeing through. Where is that most likely to happen? And he suggests it happens just in straightforward connection with other human beings. A moment of genuine openness where you and the other person become thin. Become thin as in not separate, not thin as in emaciated. So that's, so in a way, I want to talk about Vyava a bit more, but that's just some, like how we can benefit from the Sangha. Well, yeah, there's three ways we can be, like direct teaching, encouragement, exemplification, and then some degree of connection, some degree of, connection, communication, friendship, kind of like going again, like kind of penetrating into each other's lives a bit more, being touched by each other. So it's important to emphasise that this isn't just for the new people, as it were. The Buddha wants to communicate. Like, Buddha, enlightenment is relational. Enlightenment engages with the world. The Buddha communicates. The Buddha had a clear choice. He could have just sat in the jungle having quite a nice time, but he didn't. He went out to meet people because he wanted to. Yeah, he wanted to engage with the world. The Buddha used to go and sit on the edge of cities because he wanted to encounter people, he wanted to meet people. That's part of the nature of enlightenment. Okay, so that's a kind of like a taste on that bit. So how, in a sense, because you've probably all thought about that a bit before. But then, maybe the more interesting question is, so how do we benefit for Sangha? Is that, okay, you could say there's a point where you're like, I get something from this, I like it. And then there's a certain point, it's like, well, maybe it's not just about me. Maybe it's about more than that. When we're doing the refuges and precepts earlier, I've never had this before, but I had a little kind of mental slip where I nearly said the wrong words. And what I was going to say is, with acts of loving kindness, we purify our bodies. Yeah. So it's like I don't know if anyone's ever said that before. Deeds of loving kindness. With deeds of loving kindness, I purify my body. And for some reason, my mind just kind of slipped, and it wanted to say, with deeds of loving kindness, we purify our bodies. Quite interesting, wouldn't it, to try that? I had to come back and kind of remember what I was doing, but I was just like, oh, that would be really interesting. What if we said it like that? So how do we benefit the Sangha? So another little story from the Pali Canon. This is towards the end of the Buddha's life. The Buddha, by this time, is quite an influential figure in northeastern India. He hangs out with kings, he talks to kings, people come and talk to him who aren't interested, just interested in Buddhism. And there's a evil king, evil inverted commas, well, he killed his dad, that's pretty not great, even for kings. He was definitely not a follower of the Buddha, but he kind of like, for he knew the Buddha was a clever chap. He knew the Buddha was a wise guy. So he sent one of his advisors to the Buddha to ask him a question. So there's all these different rival kingdoms, and you've got this king over here who's kind of like starting doing the whole king power, kind of like he's building a kingdom. And over here there's this kind of peaceful confederation of, I don't know how you describe them, sort of like democrats or something like that, a much more collective, peaceful grouping of people. I think they're called the Vajavins, something like that, yeah. So the evil king wants to go and invade this place and conquer it. These people are really into the Buddha. So the evil king sends his advisor to the Buddha, and he sends him with a question. And he says, the advisor's question is, what would have to happen for these people to be conquered by me, the evil king? So the Buddha obviously, presumably, doesn't want this to happen. So it's sort of like one of those slightly complicated questions. What do you make of this? So the Buddha did is he asked his attendant, his best friend Ananda, and he asked him a series of questions. He said, Ananda, do the Vajravins do blah blah? Do they do this and that? Do they do the other? Do they do, the fourth thing? And Ananda keeps on saying, yeah, they do, Buddha, they do. Yeah, they do that as well. And they do all these kind of things which maintain harmony, communication, kind of like a good and just civil society where everyone is connected and gets on with each other. So the Buddha asks Ananda this series of questions in front of the evil advisor who's here to conquer those people. And Ananda says, yeah, they do this, they do that. So then the Buddha gets to the end of it and says, well, whilst the Vajravins are doing all these things which maintain and promote ethics and social cohesion, then they will not be conquered by outside forces. So in a way, he's saying, look, evil king guy, back off. These people are kind of doing okay. Leave them alone. Unfortunately, the evil king guy's advisor is more cunning than that. He says, aha, so while these people are ethical, in good communication, and maintaining social harmony, we won't be able to conquer them. Ha, 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 ha. And he walks off. And then, so he goes back to his king and says, right, what you need to do is you need to send a bunch of saboteurs, agent provocateurs, and terrorists into this nation, undermine all the sources of social cohesion and harmony, then they'll be ripe for conquest, which is what they do, and they get conquered, and that's another story. Interestingly, in terms of greater Buddhist history, this guy, this evil king, is actually the guy who, it's his dynasty which gets to the point which becomes King Ashoka, who's the most... Well, the only truly Buddhist king in history, who actually is the reason that Buddhism spread across the world, because he was a very powerful conquering king who conquered a lot of India. And then at the moment of his greatest victory, he kind of saw the bloodshed that he'd inflicted, converted to Buddhism and became a kind of righteous king. And he sent people out. So he sent people to Sri Lanka and China and Greece and Tibet. And that's how Buddhism became a global religion. Anyway, it's another story. So the Buddha had been asked this question, what is it? Why do people stay together and why do people fall apart? And reading into the story, he was quite struck by that. He was getting old, it was towards the end of his life, arguably in the last few months of his life, and he's like, you know, he'd just spent 30 years kind of creating a community, creating the Sangha, and he's like, So he was struck by this and he was concerned, you could say. So he got Ananda to call a whole big bunch of monks together. And he proceeded to, and he talked to them. And in a way, he talked on the same theme as he'd spoken to this king's advisor. What is it that keeps the Sangha strong? What is it that keeps the Sangha alive? And he proceeded to say seven things. He said that the Sangha, the spiritual community, needs to meet regularly in large numbers. So here we are, once every 2 months, sort of regular, reasonably large numbers. So we're having a go at that. They meet in harmony. Harmony is a lot you could say about harmony. They respect teachings and teachers. That's interesting, isn't it? Respect. What is it to respect a teaching? What is it to respect a teacher? They're free from craving, both internally and externally. Yeah, there's quite a lot in that. And then the seventh one, he says, which is one I want to just, in a way, just explore a bit, because I find it the most interesting. He says, and this is to directly quote, so long as the Sangha establish themselves in mindfulness with the attitude that in the future, good companions in the spiritual life will come to them, and those who have already come shall live at ease with them. They will be expected to grow and not decline. Yeah. So I'll read that again. So long as the Sangha establish themselves in mindfulness with the attitude that in the future good companions in the spiritual life will come to them, and those who have already come shall live at ease with them. They will be expected to grow and not decline. So kind of like, what does that mean? I must be completely honest with you, I don't feel like I really know. It's one of those bits, every now and again, when you read the Buddhist teachers, you hit something, I'm like, that's really important, but I don't quite get it, I don't quite know why. But let's have a little go. Well, I suppose, first of all, it brings out this thing which I think is really important just generally. He says they establish mindfulness with an attitude, yeah, with a specific attitude. You could say one of the defining you know, in our culture, you know, mindfulness is the boom thing. You know, like I was reading an article about it the other day. If you Google mindfulness, you get like 24 million hits or something like that. It's probably more than that. So they establish themselves in mindfulness with an attitude, with an intention. Do you remember at the start when we talked about saluting the shrine and the refuges and precepts? It's like, it's not good enough to be mindful. You have to have you always have an attitude. The question is, are you aware of it, and is it a helpful one? we always have a disposition, something that's leading us, something that the kind of a principle under which we do something. So yeah, with the attitude. And the attitude you have is that in the future, good companions will come. So what does that, what does that evoke? Well, I suppose in a way it evokes a number of things, doesn't it? So this question is that, how do we benefit the spiritual community? Well, if we have this attitude, then we're benefiting the spiritual community. We're keeping it strong. We're keeping it alive. And what you could say is that part of what, the spiritual community isn't a thing. It's just this kind of like, it's this jumbling mass of human beings who are having a go. And somehow we're all kind of like bubbling through life. And that stream of energy needs people to continue it. Yeah? You know, there's been millions of people practicing Buddhism down throughout history. Most of them, we have no idea who they are, what they did, where they lived. But they all contributed to this flow of energy, which means it's alive and here for us today. One of my best friends really loves this as an image, you know, like in a way his kind of guiding principle in life is that he's just going to be one of those people that, you know, like in hundreds of years' time, nobody will have known his name, but he's been part of something bigger than him. He's contributed to something. He's kept something alive. He's kept it going for other people. You could say the same's true. Yeah, like if you look at the early years of Triratna Sangharakshita, you know, these days to get ordained, to enter the Triratna Buddhist order, it's quite a substantial training process, which takes years, and you have to really, there's a lot of training involved. In the old days, in the early days, sort of Shantiprabha's kind of era, like most of you have been around long enough to have been ordained. How long had you been coming when you got ordained? 2 years? 3 years. So Shantiprabha got ordained 3 years after first contact. So yeah, probably half of you in this room, that would count. Go back 5 years before that, and you'd been around for about 6 to 9 months, and Sangharakshita would ordain you. Yeah. Why was he doing that? Because he was trying to build momentum. Yeah, and he knew that half of those people were going to blip out. But he's like, you know, you just got to get going. So in a way, we can see ourselves as that. We're helping be part of something. By our very presence, we contribute. Like in a way, it's obvious, isn't it? Like if you weren't here, then I couldn't be doing this. Although there's a famous example of in India, this is a Hindu organization, the Ramakrishna Mission. It's got a huge temple, like a city-sized temple. And the guy who founded that temple used to give a talk every week on a Thursday night, whether or not there was anyone there. Yeah? And for quite a long time, there was no one there. So he'd stand up in a town square and give a 60-minute presentation of Hindu philosophy to the space, because there was nobody else there. 20, 30 years later, there's a huge temple and millions of people go there every year. We have this attitude that good companions come and we live at ease with those around us. It keeps on coming back to this attitude of just being more open to other people, open to the world. Obviously we all know, you walk out into the streets of Birmingham, you could walk around the streets of Birmingham trying to be open to the world. You probably find that's a somewhat uncomfortable experience and you probably wouldn't want to do it for very long. So realistically, we have to do that sensibly, judiciously. You know, you can't open your heart all the time. I had a friend who used to work in the checkout at Tesco's, and she said what she tried to do was completely love every single individual who came to her checkout. And I was like, I think that's bonkers, quite frankly. Yeah, she was a bit bonkers, but... So we have to be realistic about it. So when and how do the distinctions break down? When and how do we become a bit more open to other people? So I just want to say a few bits and then kind of sum up. Humans are inevitably social creatures, yeah. We are social creatures. You cannot escape it. So that's, in a way, that's premise one. We need something bigger than us. Yeah, I think this is really important. Like, we need something bigger than us. Sangha invites you to be yourself with others whilst they be themselves. So in a way, so what can you give for Sangha? You can give yourself. Yeah, that's the only, in a way, that's all you can give. You can give yourself being yourself, and somehow that creates this opportunity for other people to be themselves and for some kind of magic, some kind of momentum to grow. Yeah, for momentum, in a sense, it's for momentum, for motivation to grow. The other thing that Sangha can give us is, it's seeing that it's not about a monoculture, it's not about being all the same. So one of the gift that you give the Sangha is just being yourself. And, you know, you be yourself and other people yourself be themselves, and somehow something happens. It's an invitation to others. It's an encouragement. It's a support. In a way, it's as simple as that. So how do we benefit the Sangha? We show up and we kind of join in this kind of whirly swirl of people having a go. And in a way, it's this funny thing, we all need to do that because we all need to be part of something bigger than ourselves. You know, I recognise that, in psychologically speaking, I'm quite substantially on the extrovert end of the spectrum, and this isn't an extrovert-introvert thing, actually. Everybody needs something more than themselves to be part of. So we benefit the Sangha by doing that. Because if you weren't all here for me to be part of, then I'd just be like, I can't quite be bothered on my own. I need to be part of something bigger than me, and that benefits me, and it benefits the wider community. So anyway, those are just some, kind of like, in a way, that's just a bit of stuff to get you going with, really. How we benefit from the Sangha, through direct learning, through exemplification, and through connection. How do we benefit for Sangha? By joining in the sort of like the weird energetic momentum of human beings having a go. Yeah. And you could say that we're doing that, you're also doing that for the future. If at some point people stop trying to practice Buddhism, then once they're all dead, there'll be nobody to teach anyone else. So actually you're just benefiting the Sangha by being part of this ongoing thing. And the other way you benefit Sangha is just by being yourself and kind of like manifesting diversity, you could say. And there's something in that where we're trying to see that we're not the centre of the universe. And you can do that by kind of seeing somebody who's completely different to you. It's like, wow, God, you're really different to me. But somehow you're the same as me as well. And kind of connecting on that level, it helps both of you and helps the people around you.